This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
For your minimum daily adult requirements of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Boy, a lot going on tonight. Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton will be debating each other. That should be interesting. We'll be following up on that tomorrow. Today, Bruce Springsteen came out and endorsed Barack Obama. Joe Lieberman said that he's willing to play the role of Zell Miller at the Republican convention. The world is strange. The world is genuinely strange. And speaking of the world being strange, we've been watching for the last couple of days this spectacle in Arizona and in Texas, and largely in Texas, where this group of polygamists, the fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon, the official Mormon Church, and I'm sure any Mormons would want it made very, very clear that this is a group that is very distinct from the Mitt Romney, Harry Reid variety of Mormons. There has been a clear cleavage between these two groups. So, I mean, these guys are to Mormonism the way that the voodoo-practicing Catholic cults in the hinterlands of Haiti are to the Pope. I mean, so let's just make it very clear that there's a distinction here. That said, speaking as somebody who worked in the field of that involved Child Protective Services, I was the executive director from 1978 to 1983 of the New England Salem Children's Village, a residential treatment facility for severely abused and emotionally disturbed kids in New Hampshire, which is still there. I'm still on the board. It's one of the better child caring programs in the Northeast. And since then, we've also added a school for ADHD kids, a Hutter School. We worked with and saw, you know, abused kids, abusive parents, the whole thing, and I am just, you know, I'm watching this with a certain amount of horror. Here you have guys with guns going in and pulling these kids out. And yet we also have to acknowledge, and this is the terrible gray area. We also have to acknowledge that polygamy as practiced by this fundamentalist Mormon sect in Arizona, Texas, and southern Utah, principally in Arizona and Texas, Warren Jeffs sect, he's now in jail, is exploitative of women and exploitative, highly exploitative of children, frankly. The part that is not discussed is the cultural context of this. And there's really two dimensions to this cultural context. The first is that this is basically a cult community. This is a community that is very introspective. They don't associate themselves with the outside world. They by and large don't have television and radio. They live in a very, you know, separate from the rest of us. That in and of itself is not a crime and shouldn't be. If it were, we would be busting the Amish. And we're not. In fact, a lot of us look at the Amish and respect, you know, what they're doing. If it were, then Hasidic Jewish communities would be under assault. If to some extent, I mean, they're a little more modern than the Amish. But if there were ashrams, and for that matter, monasteries would be under assault, and they're not. So it's not about being separate from the world. And in fact, I think that we have a long tradition in the United States of honoring differences, cultural differences. The problem is that polygamy, which is still practiced around the world, in fact, a very interesting statistic, of the 1,231 societies, individual societal cultures known around the world, 453 practice polygamy occasionally, 588 practice polygamy frequently. Only 186 are monogamous, and 4 are polyandrous, which means that wives have multiple husbands. But you have to understand the cultural context that this comes out of, and this is why it is so dysfunctional what's going on in Arizona and Texas. and why, in my opinion, the solution is not to go in with guns and grab the kids, but rather, if you, with or without guns, to go in and say, you're going to open this community up at least to social services, at least to make sure that the children are not being exploited. And here's the problem. And the problem has to do not exclusively with the, you know, the 14-year-old girls being married off. I mean, that's the big, everybody is hysterical about, oh my God, you know, underage girls being married to these guys and, you know, the 16-year-old with the four children, that kind of thing. That's the stuff that gets the big headlines. But polygamy evolved culturally. Polygamy evolved in warrior societies. Thousands of years ago, in societies that were constantly engaged in resource wars, in cultures and societies where people were having to move as a result of climate change or as a result of wiping out local populations of food or plant animals or plants that they could eat, and you had cultures coming into collision with each other and growing, and human cultures. And in warrior societies, a lot of men got killed because they were the warriors. And so if you end up with a ratio of 2-1 women to men, then, or 3-1 women to men, or 4-1 women to men, because the society is constantly at war, then polygamy makes perfect sense. And in fact, you know, you could probably make an argument for, I'm not sure you could probably make an argument, but some have made the argument. In fact, Phil Kilbride, an American anthropologist, wrote a book called Plural Marriage for Our Times. He makes the argument that we should legalize polygamy in the United States for older people, because the ratio of women to men when you get above the age of 70 starts really changing. Well, you know, interesting. But that's my point, is that if you have a 1-1 ratio of men to women, polygamy doesn't work. And so what has happened, you know, obviously it doesn't work because a man can't have more than one wife, because what's going to happen, you're going to have a bunch of men who have no wives. And that's the in where the fatal flaw in this is that these fundamentalist Mormon sects are culling out the boys. The teenage boys, the 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old boys who are now starting to look like or actually become competition with the older men for future brides. They are literally culled out. They use the rationale of, oh, well, you know, he was smoking a cigarette, or he kissed a girl, or he talked back, or whatever. And there is this phenomenon of these lost boys. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of boys who have been expelled from these communities for trivial offenses, essentially, so that they can maintain that ratio of men to women that you would see in a warrior society. So here, the primary disconnect that we have in the society is the disconnect of a marriage system that is based in a warrior society model that is not existing in a warrior society. And it just doesn't work. It plain old flat out doesn't work, and so it ends up being highly exploitative of the women and of the children, and frankly, we need to be paying attention to what's going on with the boys as well as the girls. And the other part of this is that it's also a, just like with warrior societies, and let's keep in mind that all of us, every single one of us, are the descendants of warrior societies. If we weren't, we wouldn't be here. The people who lost, the cultures, the societies that lost out in the early resource wars, don't have descendants. And there was a time in those warrior societies when the culture that produced the most babies was the culture that was most likely to survive, because it would produce the most men to have battle with other societies. And you've got, you know, stories of this. I mean, Solomon having 700 wives, and Joshua going into the city of Ai and killing every living thing. I mean, these are the stories of warrior societies and the movement and progression and growth of cultures during times of resource shortage. But now is not the time. Back then, there were fewer than a billion people on the earth. Back then, there were fewer than a half a billion people on the earth. Now there's 7 billion people on the earth. And if we're going to have warrior societies now, it's going to be resource wars, and that's a terrible thing. So instead of addressing this by saying, okay, we're going to have polygamy, or, you know, we're going to go back to having wars, what we need to be doing is we need to be resolving those wars. We need to be reducing our population. We need to be dealing with our food crises. We're going to be talking about that as we go out throughout the show today in part. And we need to be helping these societies, whether they be fundamentalist Islamic societies, fundamentalist Christian societies, fundamentalist Mormon societies who consider themselves Christians, to come into the modern world and say, listen, the warrior ways, whether they're the ways of suicide bombers or whether they're the ways of polygamy, don't work in this society. They just don't work anymore. And it's fundamentally not good for them as much as it's not good for all the rest of us. You know, arguably, at the time, sociologically, it might be. Not now. 16 minutes past it.
The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Hello, my friends, my homies. If you don't mind, I'm going to try to kick it old school.
So John McCain?
To the king, that's me. I'm a grumpy old man straight out of D.C. The Straight Talk Express is shiny and slick, where I built up my rep as a maverick. If you look at the facts, you might see it's a push, because most of the time, hell, I voted with Bush. Well, my friends, it doesn't matter. I don't have to say face, and I have a great chance, because the press is my base.
Ha! Your base. Ha! Ha! Your base. Ha! Your base.
The press is his base.
Ha! Your base. The press is your base.
I'm a maverick because they say I am. Support of the war. Tens of thousands. Thousands are dead, yet I'm the candidate with foreign policy cred. 100 years in Iraq is my war plan. You better believe I will bomb Iran. A ton of lobbyists working for my team. Not sure if wearing condoms helps HIV. I voted for torture even though I was. I'm the master Johnny Mac. I'm a third term of Bush.
Ha, your base. Ha, ha, your base. Ha, your base.
Yeah, he did vote for torture. And yesterday on Chris Matthews, he's going, oh, no, we shouldn't torture. And nobody said, but you voted for it, Senator. It's you voted for it. Anyway, let me tie this little riff about polygamy and the Mormons and these fundamentalist Mormons together with what's going on in the Middle East, where by the way polygamy is practiced. But these, you know, in warrior societies, and increasingly, again, I think that it's breaking down. It's breaking down their societies as well. And one of the things that, you know, one of the reasons why you have so many disaffected single young men, particularly in countries like Saudi Arabia. But here's the news. Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdi army. This is not the official army, the Mahdi army, which is under the supervision of Muqtada al-Sadr, the cleric who is in Iran right now studying to be a mullah. They are now providing aid to internally displaced Iraqis. As Peter Jewell over at the Center for American Progress Action Fund blogging about this, the big news out of the New Refugees International study is the support Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdi army has gained through providing aid to internally displaced Iraqis. Now, the Sunnis are doing this as well. The Sunni militias, known as the Sawa, or awakening groups, have taken on the same role in majority Sunni neighborhoods. As Sunnis in Baghdad get virtually no electricity or other services from the government, they rely on local militias and warlords to secure their areas and manage what services they can obtain. And it gets back to who's taking care of you. Who is providing that sense of safety and security? Who is bringing things together? Who is perceived as doing that, as providing for life, and safety, and fundamental needs? And you know, in these fundamentalist Mormon communities, in these polygamous communities, you know, clearly it's the leadership of the community that is perceived as that, at least for the people who stay there voluntarily. But this is the point that I've made so many times. You know, the reason why Hamas won the election in Gaza, the reason why Hezbollah has any kind of toehold at all in southern Lebanon, is because they're building schools and they're building hospitals and they're providing food and they're providing infrastructure needs. And this is what we should be doing. As a culture, we need to be helping provide for the needs of our people. I would submit to you that we would have less fundamentalism in the United States, and frankly, there would be less fundamentalism throughout the Arab world, throughout the Middle East, if the governments were more like the governments of Sweden, if the governments were more like the governments of France, if the governments were providing for the basic human needs of people. Yeah, it's going to cost a little more in taxes, but if the governments were providing for the basic needs of people, then you have emerging a larger middle class and a larger sense of, hey, we're all in this together, and a more cohesive and coherent society. And, you know, that, in my opinion, is a good and desirable thing. By the way, yesterday I had a conversation with a conservative who was saying, he was talking about Resolution 1441 in Iraq and Bush, George Bush and Congress. And, you know, oh, Hillary Clinton voted to go to war, blah-de-blah. And I'm like, no, that's not how it worked. I just wanted to share. I put these up on our webpage because I got a whole bunch of email afterwards from people saying, give me a copy of that letter that George Bush sent to Congress saying that there was a connection between Iraq and 9/11 and that's why he invaded Iraq. The law required him, that law, that resolution that Hillary Clinton voted for, Barack Obama opposed, although he wasn't in a position to vote, and that John McCain voted for, that said very explicitly that the president had to provide Congress. It said the president is authorized to use the armed forces of the United States as he deemed necessary and appropriate to enforce all relevant U.N. security resolutions. And in connection with this, the use of force, the president shall, prior to such exercise or as soon as thereafter may be feasible, make available to the Speaker of the House of Representatives a determination that the national security of the United States is a threat by Iraq, and that in acting pursuant to this resolution is consistent with the U.S. and other countries continuing to take necessary steps against those nations, organizations, or persons who planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001. And if you look at the letter on the White House website, whitehouse.gov, and there's a link to it from tomhartman.com, March 18th, 2003, Dear Mr. Speaker, acting pursuant to the constitutional public laws consistent with the United States and other countries continuing to take the necessary actions against international terrorists and terrorist actions, organizations, including those nations, organizations, or persons who planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001. Sincerely, George W. Bush. That's the letter he wrote. So the authorization said, if you can tie 9/11 to Saddam Hussein, then you can go to the UN. He didn't go to the UN. And you have to tell us. And he did tell us, yeah, 9/11. And he was wrong.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
When no one's on the run.
34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman Program, powered in part by the Teamsters Union, holding Waste Management Incorporated accountable in the fight for worker safety. You can find out more at teamster.org. Somebody forwarded me an email talking about how some of the right-wing talk show hosts are going off about speaking of kids, these girl fight videos and these girls who are fighting in this video that got all this publicity, and how they're facing 15 to 30 years in prison. And I just have to say, you know, there's a reason why kids have different rules, why we prosecute children differently than we do adults, and why we have rules protecting children. I mean, here's the Pope apologizing for all the abuse of the clergy in the Catholic Church. There's a reason why because their cognitive faculties aren't fully developed. Their self-control is not fully developed. I remember as a kid having the crap beat out of me on the playground as we're actually on the way home twice. That's really seriously having the crap beat out of me by the local neighborhood bully. And if I had to live with knowing that he spent 30 years in prison because of that, I think I'd have a problem with it. I mean, I would have no problem if he spent a few months in the juvenile detention facility, or if he had to do community service, or if there was some sort of, you know, serious punishment that caused him to take seriously what he had done, reform his ways, and become a reasonable citizen. But 15 to 30 years in prison? You put a 15-year-old in prison, a 16-year-old in prison for 15 to 30 years, they are not going to come out as a decent citizen. Our prisons turn people into institutionalized, damaged people. I mean, our prisons do enormous psychological damage to people. And very often physical damage. A lot of people don't physically survive the process of going to prison. I mean, you know, tuberculosis is exploding, HIV is exploding our prisons, and on it goes. So, I think it's so sad that there is this right-wing call for vengeance. You know, let's try to rehabilitate these kids. Obviously they should be punished. But let's not destroy their entire lives for, you know, what was a stupid and insane behavior, in my opinion. Mark in Ventura, California. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
Good morning. How are you, Tom?
I'm well. But I'm
good.
What's up?
I wanted to call in because of your comments earlier about the fundamentalist Mormon sect. And I had read a piece this morning, a very thoroughly researched piece on Democratic Underground, that described the discipline that the fathers in these families use as basically being waterboarding children.
Yeah, no, there's some terrible child abuse apparently that is going on, and that's why I said what they need to do is they need to open up these communities so that, just like, you know, any family in America, basically, you know, social workers have incredible power in our society, in our culture, and if there are allegations of child abuse, you know, they can come into your home and find out, and they can, you know, question people and whatnot. But to go into this community and pull 400 kids out all at once, I think was just stupidly done. I think that they should have opened up the community and they should have gone in there rather than bringing them out. But you know, I may be wrong on this, but I don't think so. I, you know, just based on the experience that I've seen and had working with abusive families, although I've never worked with a cult like this.
Yeah, pretty rough. It may be that they really weighed it as well as they could, and they figured they couldn't get a straight story out of people unless they were out of there. So.
Yeah, and this is one of the problems, is that one city in Arizona, apparently the local sheriff is also a member of the church, and, you know, they get no backup from law enforcement. So it's a tough one, Mark. It's really a tough one. How do you deal with it? And thank you for your call. How do you deal with this? It's a very, very difficult one. Herb in Annapolis, Maryland. Hey, Herb.
Herb, that's something Alex Bennett would relate to.
What's that?
Herb.
Alex is a great guy. What's the point?
Hey, listen, I want to agree with you. Maybe these girls should not get 15 or 30 years. I agree. That's a little bit ridiculous. But let me tell you, Tom, they beat that young lady without mercy. I understand that her father couldn't even recognize her.
No, I understand, and I agree, and I think that there should be a serious punishment for this. But 15 to 30 years?
Yeah, and you say that when they come out of the system, they wouldn't be good people. They aren't good people right now, and that's part of the problem. Alex, if it were my child that got beat up like that, I would be hunting the fathers.
Yeah, and going after the parents, yeah. Yes, and we have this video game society that celebrates violence. We have a dysfunctional culture. We need to be looking at this as a symptom, not as a cause, as a symptom of a cultural meltdown. And frankly, just stomping on people is not
right.
Gonna, you know, stomping on the symptom is not gonna cause, it's not gonna solve it's not gonna cure the underlying problem. And I mean, you've got a lot of parents now. You've got a lot of kids right now who are growing up in families where they rarely even see their parents because 28 years of Reaganomics, both parents have to work constantly, you know, 50, 60, 70 hour weeks. Not, you know, and I have no idea if this is the case with these kids in this video. Something, I mean, you go on YouTube.com and just type in girl fight and there's like 77,000 hits. Waking people up and saying, no, this shouldn't be a major fad and this is not a cool thing. That's a good thing to do. And making an example of these kids, great, you know,
and their
all in favor of it. And their
and
parents.
And their parents.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But 15 to 30 years, I'm sorry, for a teenager, you know, that's over the top in my opinion. That's my take on it. Herb, thanks a lot for the call. Jeff in Austin, Texas. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Just fine. What's up?
Big fan. Thought I would correct you on something you had said earlier.
Yeah.
To begin with, I totally agree with you regarding the girls. I think that 15 to 30 is a little heavy-handed. However, you had mentioned, you know, we have laws to protect children, and I'm just paraphrasing here, but you had alluded to the fact that, you know, it was a very steep punishment for kids. But Florida decided to charge these children as adults.
Right.
And in that vein, they're going to get the punishment that an adult got.
Right. And
now,
I think the
crux of the issue is they probably should not have been charged as adults.
Right, that's my point.
Yeah, okay.
That's wrong. Apparently there were one or two kids here who were involved who were 18 or 19, and there was a boy involved who was essentially a ringleader, and he was older, and yeah, throw the book at him. But you know,
maybe we need to introduce legislation that starts holding parents more accountable for the actions of their kids. If we're going to go ahead and we're going to say, well, we're not going to charge your child as an adult, we're going to charge him as a juvenile. However, when we do charge children as a juvenile, we go after the parents more.
And at the same time, we need to be supporting families in this country. We do not support families. The primary way that you support a family is with a living wage.
I agree. I know there are a lot more variables involved in this.
Half of all children right now come home in America. Half of all children come home to a home that is empty.
Right.
Every single day after school. 50% of all kids in America come home to an empty home. That's not right, number one. And number two, 10% of all kids in America are on food stamps. That's not right. I mean, we have, you know, pervasive poverty. It's leading to illiteracy. It's leading to school dropout. Most of these kids can't even imagine the possibility of getting into college. So they're saying to hell with it, and they're checking out of school. You know, spot on, Jeff. Thank you very much for your comment. David in San Antonio, Texas. You think my assessment of polygamy is wrong?
Yes, sir. Your assessment is incorrect. Like I told your screener, I'm a Muslim. And in Islam, polygamy came about because the women numbers dominate the male numbers. So
right, because it was a warrior society.
Come again?
Because it was a warrior society, and the men died in wars.
No, Islam has never been a warrior society.
Well, they lived in times. I'm not identifying Islam. I'm saying it was the times. All of the societies, all the cultures of that time in that era were warrior societies because you had a small area where you could produce food and you had a lot of people there who were colliding with each other. But as far as I know, there's only two ways that you're going to have more women than men. One is at the end of life, because women tend to outlive men. So, you know, if you're talking about 60, 70, 80 year olds, yes. And the other is if men are fighting wars or fighting saber-toothed lions.
Yeah. Well, yes. But Allah just mentioned that every woman should have a husband and not be alone. That's why in this country and even all Westernized societies, that's why you have a lot of men who are going out there committing adultery. But if a man was allowed to have, let's say, two, three wives, a man would not be concerned about running around and running in the streets. You can look at your governors, your ministers.
But what about the, you know, we have one-to-one, more or less, men to women in our society, at least under the age of 70. What about the guys who are left out?
There should be nobody left out.
So do the math for me then.
Okay, you do the math. I mean, you have the statistics. I don't.
If there's 100 men and there's 100 women and you want one of those guys to have five wives, it seems to me like, you know, or if you want 20 of those guys to have five wives, it seems to me like there's going to be 80 guys with no wives, and that seems to be a problem, you know. I don't get the math. You know, as I said, in a warrior society, or arguably in a hunter society, a very, very violent society, maybe it makes sense, but not in our society. Not in our society.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah, when we fall down in life, we best get up again. Many are the trials and tears we must overcome.
So what was the old limerick? from Lyme in Dorset, England. There was an old fellow of Lyme who lived with three wives at one time. When asked why the third, he replied, "One's absurd, and bigamy, sir, is a crime." Yeah. And then, of course, the old joke, you know, Muslims don't recognize Jews as the chosen people. Jews don't recognize Jesus as the Messiah. Protestants don't recognize the Pope as the head of the Christian Church. And Baptists don't recognize each other at Hooters. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But if you want to get into really strange stuff, when a male resident at a nursing home in Kildegarden, Denmark, made an indecent sexual proposal to a member of the staff, the home's director, Inger Marie Kirsten, told the nurse to telephone for a prostitute. Kirsten said in an interview, "There was a considerable change in his demeanor after the escort girl had paid him a visit. We do this for our clients just as we offer them other services that they need as human beings." Kildegard, located 100 miles west of Copenhagen in Skanderborg, has about 100 residents, including victims of Alzheimer's disease and strokes. Nurses arrange visits by call girls three times in the past 3 years. And Louise and I are going to visit Denmark in a couple of months. I don't know if I'm going to check into a nursing home there or not, though. So, Richard in Boston. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Nice to talk to you. I only get to listen to you 1 hour a day on Sirius. I really hope that they expand your program on Sirius.
Yeah, well, they carry the rest of the show a little later on in the day. But point made, Richard. That's not what you called about, though, right?
Right, exactly. The reason why I called is the gentleman who called earlier about the need of men to have more than one wife because otherwise they're going to go out and commit adultery, I think is the height of sexism. Because why don't women need more than one husband?
Well, there actually are four cultures in the world that do practice polyandry. But, you know, I would say the simple answer is testosterone, the most dangerous drug in the world. My point was the polygamy, you know, setting aside moral issues, that there have been times and cultures where polygamy made sense, and that's why you find it in the Bible, and you find it in the Quran, and you find it throughout history in some societies. But it doesn't make sense in a society, again, setting aside morality, just, you know, looking at it as a sociological phenomenon, it does not make sense in a society where there is parity between men and women. Just doesn't make sense. So, yeah, thank you, Richard. Well said. Tim in Portland. Hey, Tim.
Good morning, Tom. I had no idea about this girl beating thing, but it seems that you talk about a cultural zeitgeist of violence. But if we're not going after the administration for certain crimes of violence and allowing violence to happen, doesn't that desensitize our whole country? I mean, you talked about the ringleader should be prosecuted. We have a ringleader that should be prosecuted, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's, you know, back during the Vietnam War, it was very popular to say, you know, the war comes home. And the war does come home. And when a nation wreaks violence upon another nation, when we institutionalize mass murder, which is what war is, it's legalized, institutionalized mass murder. And let's not pretend it's anything other than that. Now, it may be necessary at times to do that, but broadly speaking, most wars are, you know, morally wrong, and certainly this war in Iraq is morally wrong. And that, you know, when we do that, I think it frankly desensitizes the entire civilization, our entire culture. Brian in Everett, Washington. Hey, Brian.
Hey, girls getting beat on the video, and the perverse thing is that some people enjoy that in a really perverse way. And I think when it comes down to the act of video, that's kind of like the White House saying, "Well, we're going to use this technique and see the video of this and that kind of stuff." And it does set the tone for the whole culture, really. And I just wanted to say that. And also, one thing about polygamy is like, how can you have that much energy? That's all I got to say.
Yeah,
and you know,
question.
I mean, give me a break. I'm trying to work. I'm trying to do my job here. I can't. I have time for that.
I know. The idea
and
is like,
I don't. I wasn't born with that amount of testosterone. So
right, Brian. And I think, you know, you speak for many of us men, which again raises the issue. You know, is some of this just, you know, very, very twisted men who are running these societies, these cultures. And I think that there's a large element to that there. Susan in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, listening on AM 1290. Hey, Susan.
Hey, how are you?
I'm great. What's up?
Okay, yes. Getting back to the topic that I started hearing was about the letter that George Bush has on his website regarding the start of war.
Yes.
And I would just like to say it's clear that he lied about it. He lied at the time. He's been lying ever since. They pulled the UN weapons inspectors out of Iraq.
That's
and
right.
They not only didn't go to the UN, they pulled the UN out.
That's right. In fact, I have, and there's a link to it off our homepage at tomhartman.com, the full text of UN Security Council Resolution 1441 on Iraq. And let me just read you sections of paragraphs 11 and 12. They're both one sentence long. It directs the executive chairman of UNMOVIC, these are the inspectors, and the director general of IAEA, that would be Al-Baradei. So basically it's Hans Blix and Mohammed Al-Baradei. To report immediately to the Council, the Security Council, any interference by Iraq with inspection activities, as well as any failure by Iraq to comply with its disarmament obligations, including its obligations regarding inspections under this resolution, as paragraph 11. Paragraph 12 decides to convene, in other words, the Security Council will meet, immediately upon receipt of a report in accordance with paragraphs 4 and 11 above. In other words, if they are told, if the Security Council is told that Iraq is not cooperating, they will convene in accordance with paragraphs 4 and 11 above in order to consider the situation and the need for full compliance. In other words, the Security Council, Resolution 1441, that Bush claimed he was enforcing, that resolution explicitly says Hans Blix has to come to them and tell them that Iraq is not complying. And then the Security Council will vote on whether or not there should be action. Hans Blix, on the contrary, was saying Iraq was complying. And the Security Council never did meet. And then George Bush went ahead and he wrote this letter to Congress saying, acting pursuant to the Constitution and Public Law 107-243 is consistent with the United States and other countries continuing to take the necessary actions against international terrorists and terrorist organizations, including those nations, organizations, or persons who planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001. Sincerely, George W. Bush. That's his letter to the March 18, 2003. You can find it on whitehouse.gov. That's his letter to Congress, and thank you, Susan, for raising that. That's his letter to Congress saying, yes, I am fulfilling the mandate of the U.N. Sorry, he wasn't, and you're right. He was lying to us then, and he should be held accountable for it.
You're in the Democracy Zone.
Democracy
with
Zone.
Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Now, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. What's going on with the price of food around the world? We're seeing an explosion in the price of all commodities. And to some extent here in the United States, these commodity price explosions, oil, gold, things like that, may reflect our deteriorating currency and some insane fiscal policies over the last 30 years. But it's happening worldwide, regardless of currencies. The Financial Times recently did a full-page article on this. Precious grains is the headline. And they point out that there have been food riots, not just in Haiti, the ones that we've seen in Port-au-Prince that made the so much coverage, but in Mexico City, in Argentina, in the Ukraine, in Egypt, in Sefro, Morocco, in Nouakchott, Mauritania, in Dakar, Senegal, in Guinea, in Conakry, Guinea, in Abidjan, in the Ivory Coast, in Douala, in the Cameroon, in India. And in fact, the country of India has banned exports of non-basmati rice, effective last October. Egypt has banned the export of rice. The Ukraine is banning the export of wheat and barley. Argentina is banning the export of soybeans. It's like the food producing countries are starting to say, hang on, we're gonna hold on to our food here, and the food importing countries are starting to freak out. Hunger is stalking the world as we approach 7 billion people. So what do we do about it? Well, as you may imagine, there are several different perspectives on this. Lena Johansson is with us. She's a Warren T. Brooks Journalism Fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org, for the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And, of course, her website, Lena, L-E-N-E, Johansson, J-O-H-A-N-S-E-N.com. Lena, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. How are you today?
I am well, thank you. And I hope you are as well. The Competitive Enterprise Institute, it seems to me that the take that you guys have, and from reading your article, which is either in or going to be in the American Spectator on this issue, is that this is not a crisis in the supply of food that really all we need is more free trade and maybe more genetically modified grains?
Well, right now, looking at right now, we have enough food in this world to feed everybody. So if you look at those countries you listed, what do they all have in common? They have a very low GDP. So if we manage to increase the economic growth in those countries by getting them more involved in the world economy, a lot of the really poor people there are going to get richer, which, you know, we know free trade have done before.
When free trade was introduced to Mexico, the middle class got poorer and the number of people in poverty expanded. When the United States started engaging in free trade in the 1980s, we've seen the average salary of working people decline. We've seen, unemployment increase. We've seen homelessness increase. We've seen our manufacturing leave. Other than China, which is very protectionist, they don't engage in free trade. If you want to import a car into China, they charge a 20% tariff, although we only charge 2% to import a Chinese car into here. Korea is very protectionist. Japan is very protectionist. Those countries seem to be doing well.
I don't
get it where you're saying free trade is going to solve the problem.
Well, what we do know is if you look at the numbers from the United Nations and if you look at the number from OECD and the World Bank, they're all saying that when countries get involved in the global economy, the poorer people get richer, and the richer people also get richer, but not as fast as the poor people.
So give me an example of a country where that has worked.
India is one of them.
India is protecting their domestic sector. You know, Walmart is having a problem right now because in India it is a felony to own more than one store. 97% of their entire retail sector is mom
India
and pop by law.
No,
India is
not,
very protectionist.
India is not as protectionist as they used to be.
They're exporting like crazy, and they're allowing us to outsource our financial services and intellectual services, telephone answering and things like that, into India. But India is protecting their economy.
Actually, India is opening up their economy, Tom, because if you look at the late 80s, early 90s, that's when they started opening up. And I actually lived on a farm in Punjab, India, in 95, which was a few years after the civil war in Punjab sort of ended. And when I went back for a wedding there with the family I used to stay with in 2000, there has been a huge change just in those few years from I was there to the first to the second time.
Sure, there's a lot of money flooding into India because there's, you know, they can do things there cheaper than we can do them here. You know, like take phone calls, provide technical support, things like that. But what does that have to do with genetically modified organisms?
Well, the thing about it is, because that's the current situation. But the thing about it is, we need to double our food production by 2050. So we need to get the second green revolution going. The first green revolution was what kind of started the decline in prices. It was around the 1940s, 1960 was the big push for that. Mm. And in those 20 years, we doubled food production, and we need to do that again.
And we did that in large part with the development of oil-based pesticides and fertilizers. Right?
Not just that. We also did. We had a revolution in plant breeding methods, actually. With crossbreeding techniques and stuff that we hadn't really.
Well, that was hybridization. That was before genetically modified. But you mentioned India. You know, you're promoting genetically modified organisms. I have an article here from the International Herald Tribune. In the Vibhadra cotton belt, which stretches across central India to the eastern part of the state of Maharashtra,
mm-hmm.
451 cotton farmers have killed themselves since the beginning of this harvest. About 2,300 have committed suicide since 2000. Of the 3.4 million cotton farmers living in the region, 95% are now believed to be struggling with heavy debt. Why? Because they are buying genetically modified cotton, this BT cotton. It was introduced 2 years ago by Monsanto into India. And I'll read from the article
I'm familiar with the story because it's been going on for a couple of months, actually, that story. And I am going.
The story was published in May of 2006, 2 years ago.
Yeah, but that story about the suicides has been going on for quite some time. And
right, because of the introduction of genetically modified foods, farmers are no longer allowed to save seeds.
I'm not so sure that's the case. That is the case that
trust me, it is.
Fancy biotechnology lobbyists want us to get out there. But
Monsanto is prosecuting people who save seeds. You know that.
Yes, they are. But that is actually not the policy they have adopted in India. They have a different licensing regime there. So there is something wrong with that story. And right now, we can have this discussion again once I actually have had time to go over there and check it out, because this is one of those stories when I read it, knowing the anti-biotechnology lobby machine,
I'm not buying this without checking it out.
Why would the solution to the global food price... First of all, you know, if Americans simply ate 10% less meat, we would have enough grain to feed an additional 60 million people. I mean, this is like, you know, conservation as a solution to the energy crisis. There are some simple things we can do. Eat a little lower on the food chain that will produce a whole lot more food. And I realize, you know, ethanol, there's some questions about ethanol as well and things like that. What I don't get is why you would suggest that, and the Competitive Enterprise Institute would suggest that turning a nation's food supply over to a private for-profit corporation that has as its first goal making a profit, not producing food, by law. You know, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, that's just the way it is. But why turning a nation's food supply over to a private for-profit corporation like Monsanto is going to solve any problems? It seems to me that it's going to create problems.
Well, Monsanto is not the only player in this game.
But they're the biggest player.
They are the biggest player, but they have also gone after the lowest-hanging fruit by going after the cereal, you know, the big cereal crops.
Sure.
One of the places we're going to get it, and this is another amazing little group, and they're also based in St. Louis, actually, is a group called the Donald Danforth Plant Science Center. Now, the number one food crop in Africa is cassava, and every year one-third of that crop dies because of a virus called mosaic. Well, they have developed a mosaic-resistant cassava plant, and this is a charity, so they're going to give this plant away to Kenyan farmers through the Kenyan Agricultural Research Institute.
That's wonderful. I mean, that's traditionally when people developed a new plant.
Right.
I mean, Thomas Jefferson hybridized tomatoes, you know, he among other things, but the tomatoes were what he was famous for. He created new varieties of tomatoes.
Right.
He didn't try to patent them.
However,
and that's what I'm saying is wrong,
happen,
is patenting these
the
things.
The Donald Danforth Plant Science Center, they spent about $1 million developing this plant. But now they're going to have to spend $20 million to build greenhouses in Kenya to do a field trial. And if you do a field trial in a greenhouse, it's not as good as a regular field trial, all because the Kenyan government have been listening to these lobbyists from Greenpeace and the Sierra Club.
Well, they've been listening to the European Union.
Jets.
You know, the European Union has banned genetically modified foods since 1998.
Yeah, but if you look at just the last week, they have... researchers and farmers all over the UK are now urging the European Union to lift this ban because there is no good reason for why it should be there. And the thing about it is, as long as we keep supporting more regulation of these crops because we don't like Monsanto, then all of the little guys...
No, this isn't that I don't like Monsanto. No, I understand your point. We're out of time and I'll...
Fine. Smaller crops to get into the market.
People can check it out, and I'll let you have the last word, Lena. Lena Johansson, CEI.org, LenaJohansson.com. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm waking up at the start of the end of the world, but it's feeling just like every other morning before. Now I wonder what my life is going to mean if it's gone. Cars are moving like a half a mile an hour, and I started staring at the passengers waving goodbye. Can you tell me what was ever really special about me all this time?
U.S. is wrestling with the worst food inflation in 17 years, writes Ellen Simon, the Associated Press business writer, pointing out that in 2007, food prices in the U.S., this is just the U.S., rose 4% versus an average of 2.5% over the last 15 years, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture is saying it could be 4.5% by the end of the year. We're seeing energy, which is having rising costs, being converted into food. Because in a very real way, we eat oil. The tractors, the pesticides, the herbicides, the fertilizers, the transportation. We're eating oil, and the price of oil is going up. And we're eating water. It takes massive amounts of water to produce food. And you know, as that continues... Well, here, just some statistics. These, you know, with the tip of the hat to John Robbins. The number of humans that can be fed by the grain and soybeans just fed to U.S. livestock is 1.4 billion. You can grow 20,000 pounds of potatoes on an acre. How many pounds of beef can you grow on an acre of land? 165 pounds. Versus 20,000 pounds of potatoes. Yet 56% of all U.S. agricultural land is devoted to the production of beef. Meanwhile, 40,000 children a day starve in this planet. If just 10% of Americans were to just reduce their intake of meat by half, we could feed 60 million people. And the amount of water, I mean, the production of waste, the total U.S. population is producing 12,000 pounds a second of waste, right? All the toilets flushing in America and industrial, everything, 12,000 pounds a second. The total production of waste by U.S. livestock, 250,000 pounds of waste per second. And most of it is not processed by sewage systems. I mean, we are eating water and food, and as a consequence, water and oil, and as a consequence, all around the world, people are starving. Now, let's also acknowledge that the year John Kennedy was sworn into office, there were only 3 billion people on the planet. Today, we're going on 7. The world population has pretty much has more than doubled since 1960. And in 1930, when Franklin Roosevelt was sworn in, there was only 2 billion people in the world. In 1900 or 1901, when Teddy Roosevelt became president, it was about 1.5 billion. In 1800, when Thomas Jefferson was president, there was only 1 billion people in the world. So, yeah, we've had revolutions in the production of our food. But don't we need to be doing something about our population as well? Which, you know, brings me back to the point that I constantly come back to on this issue, and that is that those societies that fully empower women are societies that have zero population growth or even negative population growth. And there's a lot of hysteria out there about, oh, gee, negative population growth, we can't have that. We need to have negative population growth. And it is not going to lead to a shortage of labor. It's going to lead to an increase in the price of labor, which is going to lead to an increase in the standard of living of the middle class. It always has. Whether the shortage of labor was produced by things like the typhoid epidemics in, for example, in New York City in the 17 and 1800s, you know, Edgar Allan Poe fled New York City because they were having a cholera epidemic in the water system. People were dying off. What happened? The price of labor went up. As the price of labor went up, unions started emerging and middle class started growing. Now, obviously, we don't want to have cholera and typhoid epidemics to bring this about. But in Europe, in the 1400s, the Black Death in the 1430s led to, killed off a third of Europe, led to a shortage of labor. That shortage of labor drove up the price of labor. And what emerged? The Renaissance. The first European middle class is a consequence of that. So I say, yes, let's have negative population growth. Let's get something, let's get this right this time. Let's look at the real core issues. The real core issues have to do with how we're producing our food, what kind of food we're producing, how high on the food chain we're eating. And frankly, it's destructive for our own health to be eating high on the food chain. And how we're transporting it, all these kinds of things, and what kind of population we have on this planet. Those are the primary things in the mix, in my opinion. I frankly don't think that the solution to this is, let's turn the world's food production over to a small handful of privately held corporations or even publicly traded corporations that are going to patent foods. I think that life forms should not be patentable, period. It's just absolutely wrong. We're seeing the destruction of species. And I believe it's in Norway, way up north, somewhere in one of the Scandinavian countries. They have built a vault to store seeds, thousands of different kinds of seeds, to preserve them from extinction of all these different species that have been used as food crops by humans and as medicinal plants by humans. I mean, we're looking at massive extinctions. 27 minutes past the end.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
went skydiving, I went Rocky Mountain climbing, I went 2.7 seconds on a full name Fu Manchu, and I looked deeper.
866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, AirAmerica.com, for the blogs and information about what's going on there. Lucian in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Lucian, what's on your mind today? Thanks for listening to KPOJ.
Hey, thanks, Tom. I just wanted to disagree with your guest from the American Enterprise Institute.
Competitive Enterprise Institute, yeah.
You know, she made the assertion that, or the implication, I should say, that the Green Revolution was sort of universally successful. You know, it wasn't. You know, in a lot of places, the way that we imported agriculture to these communities, we provided it on our model, and with our plants,
right?
And they didn't fit with the local environment, and the downside was then the people became dependent on all of the inputs.
Right. That's my point, is that if particularly you're talking about things like, you know, using herbicides and pesticides and monoculture,
to drive the tractors,
right?
And
intensive agriculture. And yes, that created a dependency. That was a form of colonialism, arguably.
Yeah.
But it goes on steroids when you tell people that they can't save their seeds because you own that life form.
Absolutely. And Monsanto's got lawsuits pending against a lot of people.
Right. Up in Canada, they actually nailed a guy and, I believe, successfully prosecuted him because his next-door neighbor was using Monsanto products, and they, as I recall, it was Monsanto, and the pollen blew across onto his crops, and some of the DNA from those genetically modified, as I recall, it was corn, showed up in his, and he was saving his seed and replanting his stock, and they're going, wait a minute, you're stealing this stuff. No, it blew over. Lucian,
right.
Thank you very much. Good point. Well made. Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
It always bothers me the way these people present those of us who are against GMO stuff. I just tell people to look at two words, cane toads.
Cane toads are an invasive species.
That are right. Wreaking destruction upon Australia. They're just spreading at a rapid rate. But we've had so many cases where we have released animals. This is, you know, not genetically modified animals, but just animals.
Rabbits in Australia is another good example. I mean, they led to large areas of, you know, that used to be not quite grassland, but at least, you know, semi-productive, and turned them into deserts.
Yeah, rabbits, goats, pigs, cats, all over the world, especially islands, have just wreaked destruction. And the thing with GMO is we can destroy hundreds or millions of years of natural evolution by releasing the wrong thing, the genetically modified thing, and a mistake with genetic modification is forever. You can't take it back.
If you want to see an amazing story on this, Google Planticola Klebsiella, or Klebsiella Planticola.
That bacteria that's on the roots of...
That's right. Bingo, Jeff. It's rare I encounter anybody who knows what it is. But Klebsiella is a ubiquitous bacteria. It is on the roots of virtually every plant on Earth. It's one of the bacteria that helps the roots. It's a symbiotic bacteria. It helps the roots absorb minerals from the soil, from, you know, dissolved minerals that are in the water in the soil. And without that bacteria, most plants can't live. And some scientists got this brilliant idea of hey, let's create a form of Klebsiella that has been genetically modified to convert cellulose into ethanol, and we'll be able to create biofuels, you know, simply through fermentation by using this bacteria. And they genetically modified the Klebsiella, and they were going to test it in Idaho, as I recall. They were going to release it into the environment and test it, you know, in a couple of acre test lot. And as I recall, it was a PhD candidate or a professor up at the University of Washington in Seattle. I could be wrong, but I believe it was the University of Washington who stumbled across this. In fact, I think it was one of her students came across this and said, hey, wait a minute, what happens if this stuff gets out in the wild? And they tested it in a greenhouse, and they discovered that if it got in the wild, it would cause all plant life on Earth to die.
Biological mistakes can Well, the thing is, they're self-replicating, and any biological mistake is magnitudes beyond any other kind of mistake.
Absolutely right. Yeah.
Bombs or whatever.
Yeah, and if this form of Klebsiella had gotten out, I mean, it well could have led to the death of all life on Earth. That's at least all life on Earth that's dependent upon green plants, and on soil. And we'd be back to an ocean-based life forms, and pre everything else. Anyhow, Jeff, thank you very much. It's great to hear from you, and thank you very much for the call and for listening on KKZN. Steve in Monterey, California, KRXA. Hey, Steve, what's
up? Thanks, Tom. That last comment made me think of the Germans using the fat of concentration victims for soap and their skin for lampshades.
I think that's a whole order of magnitude larger than what we're talking about here.
Anyway, your listing of food-producing nations restricting exports made me think of a film I saw called Curitiba. Have you seen that?
I have not.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about it, but while I was on hold, you contrasted beef versus potato yield, and I was reminded of the Irish potato disaster.
Right. Keep in mind, when the potato blight hit, when that fungus hit the Irish potato crop.
They were totally dependent on the potato.
No, they weren't. Ireland was exporting wheat during the time that over a million people died of starvation.
The Irish people were dependent on the potato.
That's right, because the British came in and they said, we own you, we own your land, we own your food, and you are going to export wheat to England. You may not eat it, you can only eat potatoes. And that's why the Irish starved to death.
And Ireland today could use some population, another thing you mentioned, ZPG, it seems to me, is current in formerly colonialist industrialized nations, and I'm not sure they have a right to dictate population policy in the developing world.
Right now, every environmental system, every ecological system on Earth is in decline. There are none that are not in decline.
The Chinese have mandated ZPG, but it's not because the Europeans told them to.
No, I agree. But that's a different case. There are no biological systems that are not in decline, and it's because of the human footprint. And my point is that if you want to have zero population growth or negative population growth, you don't do it the way the Chinese did by saying, okay, you're going to have an abortion if you get pregnant, mandating one child. You do it by empowering women, because when women have equal power in society, then you have, that's the correlation. People say, oh, fully modern societies, these well-developed democracies, look at this, population growth goes to zero or negative. It must be that we need to raise the standard of living in the world up to that of America. Well, I'm sorry, if you did that, you'd need four planet Earths for all the natural resources. It's not about economics. To the extent that economics relates to power, there may be some relationship, but by and large, it has to do with culture. It has to do with the empowerment of women in those societies, because there are societies where there are Middle Eastern states where everybody gets $40,000-$50,000 a year from the government just for living there from oil revenue, and yet women are held as property of men, and the average family size is 11 or 12. It's not about standard of living. It's about power. That's the bottom line if you want to get to zero population growth. Richard in Detroit. Hey, Richard. And thanks for listening to WDTW. Great.
Enjoy your program when I can catch it in between work. I respectfully disagree on the ZPG issues because I've seen how in many countries in Africa and other communities around the world where the population control measures, and I think that all societies need some type of population management, but I've seen how they've used things like forced sterilizations and other programs to disempower the women and to use them to control control the populations where they didn't like people. And when you put these ZPG programs into the hands of the capitalists and the colonialists, they really go crazy and come.
Absolutely agree with you,
Richard.
Absolutely agree with you, Richard. I totally agree, and that's why I'm saying the most effective zero population growth program in the world is simply the women's rights movement.
Well,
and you don't even have to call it a zero population growth program. You don't even have to frame it in that context. It's just that what you see is that in those societies where women have equal power with men, or relatively equal power, I don't know of anywhere it's actually equal, but there's a certain threshold that once it's passed, population will go to population growth will go to zero or will even go negative.
Well, I think though that even I mean, it's always, of course, we want the empowerment of women, but even the way that we see empowerment of women, say in the Western sense, and how it compares to some more traditionalist societies, you know, even that can become problematic if it's dictated. You know, I think if you do it education,
Richard, I'm right there with you. That's what I'm saying. You can't shove this. It's just like Bush trying to shove democracy down people's throats with a barrel of a gun. You can't do that. This has to be from the bottom up, and this has to be cultural change. Thank you very much for your call. Well said. Jay in Fort Lauderdale. Hey, Jay, just a few seconds here before the break. What's up?
Hey, first off, I'd like to welcome you to the daylight in South Florida.
Well, thank you, and it's great to be on WINS.
And I wanted to mention that on the polygamy issue, the polygamists in Utah got themselves in trouble because they were only having one marriage legal, and the other marriage, the wives were all collecting welfare, and that
right.
was really bad.
Okay.
And in the old
times, that makes sense
days,
that would be the economics of it. So they're scamming the
right.
welfare system.
Right. But in the old timey days, women used to have a major problem with death during childbirth.
Yeah.
So it might have been more acceptable back then.
Well, actually, then you'd have fewer women. That would make even less sense for polygamy.
Well, I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Different
but
times.
Your point is well taken. Thanks, Jay. You know, you got to have fewer men if you want to have polygamy work, not fewer women. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour. Ellen Ranner with the Talk Radio News Service will be with us in just a moment. But first, I wanted to get Dawn in Tempe in here listening on KPHX. Hey, Dawn.
Hi. I'm actually a survivor of the FLDS Church in Colorado City, Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to comment on some of the things people have been saying. As far as the ratio of men to women, the way they keep that equal, there's something called the Lost Boys of the FLDS.
Right. That's how I started the program, talking about that and saying that this is the only way that you can have polygamy work is if there's a radically smaller number of men than women. And the way that the FLDS Church has been enforcing that is expelling boys for the smallest infractions because they compete right. with the men for the wives.
And they often end up homeless.
Yep.
And I think that the best thing they could do for those kids is to take them out of there and to keep them. Even the mothers are part of a psychological abuse with those kids. And yeah. they keep the women illiterate so they can't read. You're married at the onset of menses, often to men who are 50 years or older.
Yeah.
And you have no choice. You can be taken from your husband and given to another man that they deem more worthy.
What, and all those things are terribly wrong. Why not, rather than pulling the children out and putting them in foster homes, because I can tell you, having worked in that business, there's an enormous amount of child abuse in the foster care industry as well. Plus,
right.
children are not with their parents, and that's an incredibly traumatic thing. Why not simply force the communities to open up and to be available to social workers and to have public education and join our society?
Well, one thing I can say is that you're raised from birth with the idea that the outside world is this evil entity, everyone in the world out of your community.
Right.
And
but if the society was forced to open up, that would fall apart, wouldn't it?
It probably would if they were forced to. The problem is in these communities, in these towns where they have these cults, often law enforcement is involved in the church.
Right. I know in Arizona City, the sheriff, the local police department is all members of the FLDS church.
Right. So I think maybe it would need to be a federal thing where you had outside law enforcement come in, and that might actually work. But
yeah,
they're very
one.
Insulated.
It's a tough one. Dawn, thank you very much for calling
sure.
and sharing your experiences with us. I appreciate
mm-hmm.
it. And thanks for listening to KPHX. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C. today. Ellen, our daily news update of what's going on in the world. What's up?
Well, I got news for you. I was at the White House this morning watching the Pope speak when Jay Tamboli emails me just after having left the Supreme Court that they 7 out of the 9 justices have now said that lethal injection is okay. Now, this is on the Pope's birthday, on the Pope's visit to the United States. So big mouth me is probably going to get myself in big trouble in the Middle East. They're taking bets at the White House press room about how long it's going to take before somebody throws me out of the country. Anyhow, big mouth me walks up to all, there were 300 bishops there today.
Right.
And they're leaving the White House in a big purple parade, looking quite terrific. And so I stop a group of each bishops as they're going, and I say, look what the Supreme Court did on the Pope's visit to the United States. And I got to tell you, there wasn't one bishop that was not extremely upset that they did this.
Yeah, because the Catholic Church is totally opposed to capital punishment.
But, I mean, what a day to issue
since the majority of the court, five out of the nine justices are Catholic, you would think that they would have figured
that
this is bad timing.
That's what one of the bishops said to me. He said, there's so many Catholics on the Supreme Court.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they're, you know, literally five out of nine. You would think that they would, you know, that they'd say, wait a minute, this isn't a good day to do this. Let's wait a week.
Exactly. Also today, several other issues. The House Committee on Financial Services and on Housing, the Housing Subcommittee, which is Maxine Waters, had a hearing today. They heard from the Office of Single Family Assistance at HUD, and they tried to defend HUD, saying that that basically they had really tried to help these people. Representative Emanuel Cleaver, who is from Missouri, a Democrat, said that the country is experiencing approximately 20,000 foreclosures a week and that we have more than a casual problem, and that the Department of HUD said, well, they're trying to keep borrowers informed about the housing contracts they were agreeing to pay.
Now, this is the same Department of HUD that basically, you know, is headed up by Alphonso Jackson, who said that there's nothing to worry about a couple of months ago, and went out and had for, what was it, $100,000, had a contracted using emergency appropriation to have a painting of himself made.
The same
guy,
exactly.
Yeah, Brownie at the at HUD.
That's why Cleaver said there's more than a casual relationship. He was using some words that had been previously used. Also, Caden spoke at the behalf of the Veterans Affairs, and she said that not all foreclosures were the result of bad loans being distributed. I mean, give me a break. We know that not foreclosures of that, but a majority of them are.
Yeah.
Other news. I'm headed back to the White House today, right now, and there are several interesting things. First of all, Senator Lieberman was front and center today, right in front of the Pope, and now it looks like he may be at least open to giving a keynote address, if not one of the major keynote addresses at the Republican National Committee for his friend John McCain.
Yeah. Joe Lieberman, the new Zell Miller.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Former vice presidential candidate of the Democratic Party.
I know. It is, you couldn't write this in a novel. People, you know, it would sell about as well as Scooter Libby's novels. I mean, you know, nobody would believe it.
What's very also interesting, I just want to talk about a timing. I would say, and LaVisa sitting next to me, that the Pope was probably with the president for 45 minutes or less. Talking about issues of immigration and Islamic extremism, et cetera. But 45 minutes, not a long period of time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the Pope and the Catholic Church disagree on the war. They disagree on capital punishment. They disagree on the immigration policy. There's a lot of concerns there. Actually, Bush was in favor of the immigration reforms. I should correct that. But in any case, excellent reporting. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. And coming up next, meat guzzling.
Exposing the con in conservative con. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Zone with Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So what would the world look like if we ate less meat? Mia McDonald is with us. This is our, you know, sometimes you know what's going on, sometimes you don't know what's going on, sometimes you know what is right, and sometimes you don't, and sometimes everything you know is wrong. And I think a lot of people, everything that they know is wrong about meat is right. Hey, Mia, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me. Nice to be here.
Mia is the executive director of Brighter Green. Brightergreen.org is the website, and she will be speaking, by the way, here in my fair city in Portland, Oregon, in May. And tell us about, and also portlandvegfest.org, we'll get you there. Mia, tell us about a world without meat. What would that mean?
Well, a world without meat, it could mean some very good things for the environment, for our health, for equity in terms of how people eat. We're seeing right now what people are referring to as almost a perfect storm, where there's rising demand for meat among the world's growing affluent population, demand for grains to make ethanol to help us wean ourselves from our addiction to oil, and we're seeing food prices rising around the world, including in the U.S., but here we haven't seen major disruptions to our life or lifestyles. But in many poor countries, including Haiti, Indonesia, Egypt, we're seeing protests and real anger and fear on the part of the population because they can't actually afford to buy the staples that they eat, are used to eating every day, grains, also some vegetables. And that's largely because of this surging demand for the grains. To make biofuels is one thing, but also to fatten up animals, and that's, you know, for animal feed. So,
Mia, I would submit that we are seeing a major change in our lifestyle, and as a consequence of industrial agriculture, particularly industrial meat agriculture, because pesticide residues are, you know, a massive component of the pesticide and you know, other chemical residues that humans have in them come from eating high on the food chain.
Absolutely.
You know, we get like 1-2% of our pesticides from eating fruits and vegetables, and we get like 70-80% of it from eating meats and fish. And not just pesticides, heavy metals and other toxins, they all get concentrated. And that's causing an epidemic of neurological diseases. It's causing an epidemic of cancers. It's causing an epidemic of asthmas and other kinds of conditions. And that is modifying our way of living.
Well, you're right. And we can add to that litany of woe, we can add antibiotic resistance because the animals raised in factory farms, and I'm sure some of your listeners are familiar with that term, they are vast operations, more like prisons, one can say, where huge numbers of animals are raised very close together without any ability to be outside, to have any kind of natural behaviors. To sustain those animals and to keep them healthy, which is not really what they are, they're pumped full of massive amounts of antibiotics and hormones, and those are also bioaccumulating in people's tissues and leading to very serious problem of antibiotic resistance in terms of treating disease. So,
well, and in fact, this is where E. coli, what is it, H157, as I recall, the one that is so deadly. I mean, it evolved in factory farms. The current deadliest form of Listeria evolved in factory farms. These microorganisms that are really, really toxic and lethal now, and now we have methicillin-resistant staph, you know, MRSA. Many people are suggesting can be directly tracked back to factory farming. This intensive animal agriculture is now killing people.
Precisely. And the other issue we have is avian flu, right, which even though we haven't heard of a major outbreak of that recently, there are cases almost every week. You do hear about them if you look more carefully in many Asian countries.
Right.
Now, one response to that has been to say, hey, let's shut down the backyard producers and bring all the animals inside where we can supposedly keep them clean and have better standards of hygiene. A growing school of thought, though, is saying that actually this factory farm intensive animal confinement is actually responsible, provides a perfect breeding ground for avian flu, which we know can already transmit the species barrier and has infected humans. So I would say, I mean, the challenge in terms of this world that we are living in is we have climate change now, and we see that livestock, the FAO has done a seminal report on that, almost 20% of total greenhouse gas emissions are attributable to raising animals for meat and milk. So I would take your point, our lifestyle is being changed by this, but I don't know how many of us yet are aware of the real devastation, and especially when we look into the future, estimates suggest that meat consumption will double. We already have nearly 60 billion animals around the world being raised for food. The effects
of that for about six billion
humans.
10
animals per person, actually, because we have over 6 billion people. Now, 10 billion of those are in the U.S., so I do think as Americans, we have to grapple with the fact that this system of very intensive raising of animals, huge numbers being raised, very cheap meat readily available. Some of us can eat meat three times a day and often do. Heavy marketing of meat, especially to kids, also dairy. You know, the fact that that has devastating consequences here, but it's also being exported around the world, and that we have, you know, our government, our private industries, even some of our citizens have a role in that, and that is going to wreak even more havoc.
Now, people think of the Germans, for example, as a big meat-eating society. I lived in Germany for a year. They're really into their bratwurst and their sausage and stuff, but the fact of the matter is that Americans eat, on a per capita basis, Americans eat more meat than anybody else in the world, certainly far more, almost half again more than Germans do.
Yeah, that's true. And compared to countries like Ethiopia, where they eat about 20 pounds of meat a year, and we're eating about 200, that's a vast gap.
Right.
And yet there are forces at work to try and get Ethiopians to eat more meat, you know, because there's obviously a market there. And in many ways, the U.S. and Europe are saturated in terms of factory farms, fast food outlets, so there are, you know, it's part and parcel of the process of globalization.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, a huge challenge.
And it's such a shame. I mean, there's, for example, here in Portland, there's an Ethiopian restaurant, Dalos, that I like to go to eat at. They make their bread out of, or their injera, you know, the bread that you use, out of teff flour. So I have celiac disease. I can't eat wheat. And so, you know, I can eat that. And they have this incredible vegetarian platter, you know, with the yemisir wat, I think is the red lentils and the yellow lentils and just all these vegetables. It is so flavorful and it's so rich. It's just, it's absolutely delicious. And you know, Dalos does a great job of serving it. Why would we be running around the world saying to cultures that where meat is primarily and historically a condiment rather than a staple, that they should change their way of life to make meat a staple rather than a condiment?
Well, that's an excellent question. As you note, even in a place like Portland, and we certainly see it in other parts of the world, you know, meat is becoming more at the center of the plate, whereas it often was, if it was on the plate at all, was pushed to the side, was just a little portion. And obviously there are, you know, there's market growth, right? So to have more and more people eat meat and dairy, it benefits a number of people, including people in developing countries. And I don't mean the average person, but there are poultry barons in Asian countries who see this as a market. And actually, a lot of governments in developing countries also do see more meat and dairy as a sign of affluence, and many of their people do, and they see it as progress. And unfortunately, it's a part and parcel of the Western lifestyle that is being exported around the world.
Now, there is something to be said. There is something to be said about nutrition, and we saw in the generation following World War II, as the Japanese nutrition improved, the average height of Japanese improved. But in Holland, which has the tallest people in the world, they eat a lot less meat than we do. There is some speculation that maybe people are getting taller all around the world because there's growth hormones in the dairy products and the meat that they're eating, but I don't think that's so much the case in Japan because they, by and large, don't eat dairy products there. So shouldn't we be talking about nutrition rather than meat?
Well, and people in Japan also eat very little meat. I mean, their diet is largely seafood and vegetable-based, and some tofu, obviously, in terms of soybeans. Yes, I think nutrition is absolutely important. And obviously, what we see around the world now is many poor people being denied basically their daily bread. And that's, I would say, in a matter of equity and social justice, absolutely wrong. And we have to look at what are the forces driving that and how do we change that. In terms of nutrition, there certainly is a school that says, you know, if you can incorporate some animal foods into your diet, that might be a good thing, especially if you have very few other options. But there are many other schools that say, look, we can improve nutrition without animal foods. And so many societies historically have eaten either no or very, very limited animal foods, especially dairy. I think because we've grown up here, most of us very heavily told, you know, drink your milk and it'll help you grow tall. I mean, many societies, many countries in East Africa, you know, milk is not a daily part of the diet. That's really come in recent decades as its availability has increased. You know, as you say, Asia. I mean, something like drinking cow's milk is very unusual, but now we are creating markets for that, creating
supply. Right, and you've got a billion Buddhists who've been, you know, vegetarians for 3,000 years.
Well, and look at India. I mean, their Indians often do eat dairy products, but not a huge amount traditionally. And, you know, that's a global civilization that's been around 5,000 years, right?
There you go. There you go. Mia McDonald, she's the executive director of Brighter Green. The website is brightergreen.org, and she'll be at the Portland Veg Fest in May. That's portlandvegfest.org. Mia, great talking with you.
Well, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Thanks for the thought-provoking conversation.
Thanks for the great question.
Yeah, you're welcome. 16 minutes past the hour.
Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Past the hour, Larry Scott on the line with us, the chief cook and bottle washer over at VAWatchdog.org, keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to.
That's absolutely right, Tom. Oh, by the way, I like your previous guest about a world without meat.
Yeah.
Do you know how many GIs that would make happy? They could stand in the chow line every morning and not have to look at those huge trays of SOS.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
Which, by the way, we should explain to your listeners is military code for chipped beef on toast.
Yes. And,
right.
And we'll just leave it at that.
We'll leave it at that.
The Secretary of Defense is not pleased. I'm looking at here at your website, VAWatchdog.org, and Gates is not pleased with the VA care that the returning troops are getting. Why not? Why doesn't he do something about it?
Well, he can't. The way the agencies are set up, this is Robert Gates, Secretary of Defense. We call him the SecDef. And he just had a meeting with VA Secretary James Peak, and evidently it was not a cordial meeting. And although he stated this very politely, you know, we can read exactly what's going on here, the way this man stated what's happening. And that is the Secretary of Defense is basically saying his returning troops are not getting the timely care they need at the VA. What he said is, we can write this all down on paper in Washington and tell everyone it has to get done, but it is not being implemented at the local levels. This is, again, a function of underfunding, which leads to understaffing, which leads to veterans waiting and waiting and waiting for health care, and that's what it comes down to. But when the Secretary of Defense puts a frown on his face and says, I am not a happy camper about the care my veterans are getting in the VA, that will trickle back up to the White House.
Yeah,
if anything will be done about it, we don't know at this time.
So, you know, we saw a heck of a job, Brownie, over at FEMA.
Yeah.
And we saw Alfonso Jackson, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, 6 months ago, saying, oh, this housing thing, don't worry, everything will be fine in the spring. By the way, I'm going to spend $100,000 in emergency funds to have an oil painting of myself done. And what's the deal with Dr. James Peak, the VA secretary? Is it just another Bush appointee who's clueless?
Secretary Peak is a political appointee, and he's a less than 1 year caretaker, as you know. He's serving out to the end of the administration. He was the Surgeon General of the Army for a period of time. Was not very well liked in that position. He was known as a budget cutter and was responsible for a number of the budget cuts at Walter Reed that then trickled into outsourcing of care, outsourcing of jobs, and led to the Walter Reed fiasco, although he has very carefully tried to separate himself from that. So what we have is a political yes man who is going to do what the administration says, which is spend as little money as possible.
Right.
He has forwarded the administration's line. He is opposed to the new GI Bill. As you know, the new GI Bill being proposed by Senator Jim Webb of Virginia would virtually bring back all those wonderful benefits GIs had coming out of the end of World War II for education.
Right. And I believe it's co-sponsored by the Republican Chuck Hagel, is it not?
And yes, Hagel's on there. There are a number of Republicans, mostly Democrats. You've got over 50 senators on board, 100-plus members of the House on the House version, which is almost identical. And Obama supports it. Clinton supports it. McCain does not support it. And here's the interesting thing. The VA does not support it because they say it's too expensive and too difficult to administer. Now stop and parse that for a second. It's not going to come out of VA funds. Congress is going to appropriate it. So how expensive it is has nothing to do with the VA. They say it's too difficult to administer, but what is the VA's job? They are to administer programs funded by Congress. So that is a totally bogus argument.
So now we have the VA putting out basically ideological conservative arguments.
That's exactly right. And then, of course, the other problem, too, is the Department of Defense. The Pentagon is also opposed to the new GI Bill. They call it a retention buster. And their official attitude is, why should these guys come in for 3 or 4 years and then leave and go to school? That doesn't do us any good. They're not going to reenlist. They're not going to stay in the military. But it's been proven over and over and over. The cost benefit is there. The old GI Bill put back 7-1 into our economy.
It causes more people to sign up. And if you have more people signing up, you have more people, you know, you may have a lower percentage who stay there over the long term. But if you have more people going through the system, you're going to end up with more people staying long term.
You are exactly right. And it's a marvelous benefit, the new GI Bill. And this is starting now to bubble under as a real battle on Capitol Hill. And it's going to be a campaign issue because Senator Webb has personally invited Senator McCain to join them and sign on to the new GI Bill. He has not responded to that.
Yeah. Okay. Surprise. Speaking of not response, we're half a minute here, Larry.
Okay.
Don in Dallas, they're not responding to suicide, vets who are committing suicide.
Dallas has a real problem. Their psychiatric unit is now closed. They're taking no new admissions. 4 veterans so far this year have committed suicide, 2 of them in the unit. 2 of them immediately after they left the unit. We don't know what the problem is right now. There's an investigative team coming out from Washington, D.C. to go over the Dallas VA with a fine-tooth comb. But their psychiatric programs, especially what veterans affectionately know as the flight deck or their lockdown ward, obviously needs some work. They're having you just can't have people committing suicide in a psychiatric ward, Tom. So we'll keep following that story.
Well, you know, budget cuts are us. You know, what's it going to lead to? It's like, you know, the BBC did this study where they found that when Margaret Thatcher came into office, when the conservative policies came in, suicides in England went up. I mean, it's just in the military or out. VAWatchdog.org, one of the greatest sites on the Internet, particularly for anybody who's involved with Veterans Affairs, veteran in your family, whatever it may be. Larry Scott, thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Minutes past the hour, and from the wire services, as they say, a poll indicates the majority of Americans are bitter and clingy. Numbers could help Obama. Less than a week to go before the Pennsylvania primary, a new poll released today hints that Senator Barack Obama's controversial remarks, in which he called Pennsylvania voters bitter, may actually be helping him with a key constituency, bitter voters. According to a new poll released today by Newsweek, 54% of likely voters in Pennsylvania describe themselves either as bitter, sometimes bitter, or bitter most of the time. Drilling down beneath those numbers, the results of the poll get even better for Obama, especially when respondents answered the question, when you are bitter, what do you cling to? According to the poll, 35% said they cling to religion, 34% said they clung to guns, while 28% said they clung to antipathy towards people who are different from me. In a sign that voters who describe themselves as bitter are ready to mobilize in support of Senator Obama's presidential bid, over 1 million bitter voters took to the streets of Philadelphia today in support of the Illinois senator. The demonstration, which organizers were calling the Bitter Man March, suggests that bitter voters have found something new to cling to. According to Tracy Collusion, 35, a bitter florist from suburban Philadelphia, she said, "When I'm not too busy clinging to guns or religion, I'm going to cling to Barack Obama." Elsewhere, in a new effort to relate to voters, Senator Hillary Clinton did 5 jello shots at a bar in Pittsburgh. Yeah. Thanks to Andy Borowitz for that smile. Andy Borowitz, Borowitz Report, excuse me, .com. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, toll-free all across the United States. Tom Hartman, .com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. And, of course, AirAmerica.com. Don in Daly City, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Don, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I wanted to make a comment regarding these kids, and the issues regarding them are that
you're talking about our earlier conversation of the violent girl fight video stuff.
Yeah, there are a lot of factors involved. Nutrition, there's Ritalin given to a lot of kids, the violence in society and that, but meditation given to young kids is, and proper nutrition has been proven to be helpful. But a couple of other issues. The algae, spirulina, the blue-green algae, these things are very nutritious. So brain food is supposedly good for people like fish. And fish eat algae, like the super blue-green spirulina algae. There's a
you sell this stuff, Don?
What's that?
You sell this stuff?
No, but I met Christopher Hills, the guy who introduced algae spirulina to the country. And
I get your point. The nutrition is important, and I agree with you. And I think that we need to be looking at that. I'm also very concerned about the statistics that indicate that as many as 10% of our kids are on some kind of psychoactive drugs, and perhaps much higher in some areas, in some communities. And it seems to me, I have been looking. And I say this, as a former psychotherapist and as a guy who's written 7 books about attention deficit disorder, and I've been a consultant to school systems all over the United States, and I'm on the board of directors of a private school and have been for a decade. I helped found it, in fact, helped create it. That I have yet to see one of these school shooter things, these kids in high schools who go out and shoot the school up, where they're either not on medication or haven't recently been on some kind of medication. I have some real concerns about these SSRI drugs, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, that are now black-labeled with suicide risk. And I think that a lot of these, many of these hyper-violent crimes, at least those types, are not actually murders. They're actually suicides where they're taking a bunch of people down with them. And it really concerns me. Gregory in Vancouver, Canada. Hey, Gregory.
Hello, I've never called a show before, so I hope I don't totally mess this up.
You're doing well so far. What's up?
Well, it's just a comment about something you were talking about earlier, the Monsanto Corporation, was that right?
Monsanto.
Monsanto, that's right. You had said that they won the lawsuit against the farmer in Canada, but they had actually lost it.
Did they? Oh, okay, thank you.
I
was uncertain how that ultimately resolved itself. I know that they certainly initiated it.
I was kind of disturbed about the thought that we would rule that way, so I made sure to check.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much, Gregory. I appreciate it. It's always good to know that we've got our facts straight, and I'm telling you, we've got the smartest listeners in the world on this program. Albert in Anaheim, California. Hey, Albert.
Good morning, Tom. I enjoy your show very much.
Thank you.
I was reading a thing on that's probably in the current issue of Time magazine about Bob Zoellick's, the U.S. Trade Representative's, his concern that, with this, with these uprisings all over the third world concerning like basic food commodities and stuff,
right,
that would actually lead to the destruction of this free enterprise system as we know it.
Yeah, we're looking at some serious problems here,
mm-hmm.
and the reality is that absolute laissez-faire capitalism, totally unrestrained and unregulated capitalism.
There is no Center for self-discipline whatsoever.
Exactly. It's not going to solve the problems of the world. What it does is it creates essentially oligarchies or kleptocracies, really, would be a better
way. I'm just saying it would be nice if we could have shift. If this was to also cause the United States, if it was also to I'm hoping someday that if it ever reaches fever pitch in the United States, we could adopt like a new kind of economic paradigm, perhaps either new mercantilism or democratic socialism or something.
Yeah, I'm actually entirely in favor of democratic socialism if you're defining it as the way that is practiced in Denmark and Sweden and Norway.
And Canada, too.
Yeah, and to a large extent in Canada as well. Albert, thank you very much. Well said. Bernice in Dearborn, Michigan, WDTW. Hey, Bernice.
Hi, Tom. This has to do with meat consumption.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a longtime vegetarian, and I've begun calling restaurants such as Big Boys to encourage them to add veggie burgers and soy burgers to their menus.
Yeah.
Then it occurred to me that in the elementary school cafeterias and at daycare centers, kids love burgers, and maybe it's about time they started serving veggie burgers and soy burgers to the kids. They're delicious, and I don't think the kids would know the difference.
I agree with you, Bernice. We raised 3 kids vegetarian, and they all went through the public school system. Ultimately, one of them in high school went into a private school and another one homeschooled, but they all, all 3 of them through their early years. And at first, this was in the early 70s, actually, our oldest. the school thought that we were like something from outer space. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, you want to do what? Your child is a what? A vegetarian? But what we found is as time went on that the schools became less hostile and more friendly to it, and that it actually became kind of, you know, for our kids and for a lot of their friends, kind of the cool thing to do. And I like to see that fad. Bernice, thanks a lot for the call. Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania, listening to WPTT. Hey, Bonnie.
Hi, Tom. I was wondering if you saw the documentary King Corn that was on PBS's Independent Lens last night, and it's going to be repeated in the early morning hours tonight.
I did not, but I'll record it.
Well, it explained many of the concepts you were discussing about how everything we eat is produced in a sea of oil, and it also talked about how since cows didn't evolve eating this so-called corn, they develop ulcers in their stomachs from eating it at the feedlots in eastern Colorado, and they become sick with acidosis. So the agribusiness folks pump them up with antibiotics, so the consumers end up consuming not only those antibiotics, but this quasi-corn and the sick cows that eat that corn.
Right.
So it's not very appetizing, but it's a very good documentary.
Yeah, corn is not a grain that cows or that whole family of animals naturally would be eating, and you know they're grazers, they're ruminants.
And I don't think that people, since it's been so long now that we've been eating this crap, I don't eat that, but a lot of people eat that, that they don't know lean meat, it might be a little tough, but it's better for you if you're going to eat meat than to eat that kind of stuff.
Right, to eat the organic and locally grown and range-fed.
Right. And one last thing, I was busy when you were speaking of fermentation about an hour or so ago. I missed the context in which you spoke. But I was wondering if you read Wild Fermentation by Sander Katz, and he also wrote the book The Revolution Will Not Be Microwaved. He's a great writer.
Yeah, we got the book Wild Fermentation in the mail a couple of weeks ago, in fact.
It's great.
I haven't had an opportunity to really dig into it, but it looks like it's got a lot of great recipes for, if I'm thinking of the same book, a lot of great recipes for basically raw foods that you know, sort of like sauerkraut that are fermented.
Right.
Great.
Bonnie,
thanks a lot for the heads up. Thank you. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Tim in Santa Fe, listening on KTRC. Hey, Tim.
Hi. Hey, I like that one of the things that you were talking with the woman who was talking about the Monsanto and agribusiness and things like that is the precautionary principle.
Right. That's what they practice in Europe. That's why the EU has banned genetically modified foods, because we don't yet know what the consequence of them will be.
Yeah, and I'd love to have you, you know, ask that question sometimes of some of these people, and because, you know, one of the ideas is that you have to go and prove that it's safe
before
you go out. I worked in California with the agriculture departments, and it's a very corrupt system that we have going right now where everybody is in bed with each other.
Well, and it's right across the board. You know, there's more than 80,000 synthetic chemicals in production in the United States, and fewer than 1,000 of them have ever been tested for carcinogenesis or anything other than just pure raw toxicity.
Thank you for a great show. I love listening to you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks a lot, Tim. Bye. Pete in Chicago. Hey, Pete, what's up?
Tom, I got a simple question. I'm having a memory lapse here. What's the name of that volunteer organization that John Kennedy started? It's still in existence.
You're talking about the Peace Corps?
Peace Corps.
Yeah.
Thank you. You saved my sanity.
Okay. That was it?
That's it. Thank you.
Okay. That's an easy one. Thank you very much, Pete. Good to hear from you. Oh, the Peace Corps is a great organization. Still is a great organization. And this was an example of what we should be doing around the world. I keep coming back to this. You know, why is it that wackos get elected in countries that are under stress, you know, like in Gaza? And the reason is because they're providing people with something. We could be doing the same thing. We should have more Peace Corps and fewer bombs. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. The true people's radio. Tom Hartman.
What's died? You should know the answer if God's on our side.
So what preceded the precautionary principle, and a tip of the hat to Sue Nethercutt in our chat room, who pointed this out, is the Delaney Clause, 1958. It was an amendment to the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938. It was named after the congressman who proposed it, James Delaney of New York. And it said, the Secretary of the Food and Drug Administration shall not approve for use in food any chemical additive found to induce cancer in man or, after tests, found to induce cancer in animals. And it was actually invoked a year later, in 1959, by the Secretary of HEW when the herbicide aminotrazole, if I'm pronouncing that right, was discovered on cranberry plants in Oregon and Washington and is known to be a carcinogen. And this caused a freakout. You know, this was the week of Thanksgiving when it was announced about this. And it applied to pesticides and, you know, it was pretty strongly enforced until the Republicans took control of the House and Senate in the last years of the Clinton administration. And in 1996, they amended the Food Quality Protection Act, Title IV of it, to say that the Delaney Amendment no longer applies to pesticides. Yeah. And as Sue also noted, by the way, that the farmer in Canada who ultimately won against Monsanto first lost and then appealed and then settled out of court in a way that he said he was pleased with. Nancy, just to keep the record straight, Nancy in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Nancy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just heard you talking about the SSRIs earlier. And
yes.
I was I am an attorney, and I did for most of the late 90s, early 2000s, through the 90s and early 2000, I worked on Prozac litigation, and I was actually one of the lead plaintiff's lawyers in the Westbecker litigation out of Standard Gravure in Louisville, where he went in and shot a bunch of people and killed himself.
Right.
We took literally hundreds of depositions in that case, and some things that came out through the depositions that were really startling was, first, one of their experts, and I don't remember his name offhand right now, admitted on the stand that it does cause agitation and aggression, SSRIs.
We're talking about a family of drugs for people who are listening and don't know what an SSRI is. It's an acronym, stands for selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. What they do is they increase the level of serotonin in the brain. It's a neurochemical, and presumably, you know, makes you feel happier. And the real effect that they have is it somewhat disconnects you from your emotions. It flattens affect. It flattens the world. So presumably somebody who's overwhelmed by grief or depression or something like that will feel less overwhelmed. And, you know, arguably over the short term, you know, by flattening the lows and also flattening the highs, you know, it might be a useful thing occasionally. But the problem is these drugs tend to be habituating, habit forming. Some people find it very hard to withdraw from them. And there's all these concerns that because people feel disconnected from their emotions, they're less likely to consider the consequences of things like homicide or suicide.
Mm-hmm. They also cause a lot of agitation. We found from looking at hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of clinical trials that were run, and we had experts look at the paperwork, they were giving chlorohydrate out like crazy to cut some of the agitation that they were seeing in the patients in the clinical trial.
Chlorohydrate is the old-fashioned knockout drops.
Right. So, I mean, they were giving that stuff out liberally. So, and that was never in the package. And still, I don't think to this day is in the package insert. And then also we found there were a lot of people, including Lilly employees in Germany, who had found that the drug was causing suicide, and they were getting lots and lots of complaints. And we actually have documentation that at one point in time, before it hit the market here in the U.S., that the German Lilly employees were saying, you know, you guys are asking us to change words on adverse event reports to the German counterparts of the FDA, that really is playing down the suicidality that was happening on the drug.
Yeah, and once that became public, the FDA did require them to black label these things, didn't they?
Yes, finally. But I mean, it was it was a couple decades after the drug first hit the market.
Yeah.
So
and do you think that
the patent was gone? You know, they already lost the patent.
Right. So it wasn't as profitable a drug, so what the heck? Do you think that my concern is legitimate, the overuse of SSRIs among teenagers might be directly connected to these school shootings?
Yes, I do. I really believe that. I mean, and it was funny because when I first heard about Columbine, before I heard anything else, I said to my husband, I said, there's an SSRI involved. And I think they were, it was either Zoloft or Paxil. But yeah, I mean, it's, the thing that we found, too, another thing that was interesting was that, and very upsetting, was that people that would suicide on Prozac would suicide very violently. Usually, if you look at the old suicide attempts on other antidepressants or people who are depressed, they would take the pills and usually suicide that way. Well, one of the things that Lilly did in pushing it mainly to family practitioners in the late 80s and early 90s when it first hit the market was that you could take a boatload of that stuff and you're not going to die.
Right.
So they were actually
It was safer than barbiturates and things like that,
So they were actually targeting people who, in my opinion, really didn't have the expertise to try to monitor people on this drug. They were saying, you know, you don't have to worry about getting sued basically for when somebody commits suicide on, under your watch because they're not gonna kill themselves.
They're not gonna suicide with your product. They're gonna suicide with a pistol.
Right.
Or they're gonna suicide by killing five people and then killing themselves.
Horrible suicides. You know, a couple people would basically eviscerated themselves with knives and I mean just really, really scary stuff and it was statistically much striking how violent this is.
And the Virginia Tech anniversary is today, and that shooter was on SSRI medication.
Yeah,
we should point out.
Definitely.
Nancy, got to wrap it up. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it, and thanks for listening to us there in Chicago. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be challenging Terry Jeffrey, editor-in-chief of CNSNews.com, about John McCain's economic plan versus those of the Democratic candidates. Plus, David Korn is going to be here, speaking of Korn, tell us about Mother Jones Magazine's exclusive investigation into cops and former Secret Service agents running black operations on green groups. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it! Get out there, get active. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.